Hello, everybody. This is Tom Dorsey and Tammy DeRozier, and we have along with us John from our money management operation.
Right, John Lewis. Yep. Welcome,
hey,
John.
Hey.
Are you still shaking out there? Did y'all feel the earthquake the other day?
We felt the earthquake, but it was pretty mild, so we got our fingers crossed that that's the end of it.
There you go. Because y'all had two of them, right?
Yeah, there were a couple, and they were fairly small, but you never know when they're small whether they start out and that's how big it's going to be or whether that's just kind of the ramp up to the bigger thing. So.
There you go. Well,
you know what I don't get, John, is you guys, because of how technologically advanced we are at DWA, you could live anywhere you want to live, Hawaii, Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Why do you choose to live in L.A.?
It's the greatest place ever.
I don't get it, man. I pick
well,
up the
y'all
newspaper.
Are in Pasadena, right?
Yeah, we're in Pasadena.
Arnold Schwarzenegger's trying to figure out what the heck to do. I mean, the place is going under over there.
Oh, we have no idea how to run a state in terms of government. And the fact that California actually has rated municipal bonds is beyond me, because every time there's a recession, we basically go bankrupt. And I haven't figured out how to make that work yet. I mean, it's crazy. The politics are nuts, but you know, you can't beat the weather. You can't beat the lifestyle. It's actually a wonderful place to live, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh,
how
good.
About Bermuda? You guys could go to Bermuda.
Yeah, well,
you don't have to be in L.A.
What's that?
You don't have to be in L.A.
No. We could actually be anywhere. The way technology is, it makes it very easy to actually do this, the kind of stuff that we do from just about anywhere we want.
Well, I can tell you what, if Tammy and I were out there, we'd be saying, feet don't fail us now. We're going to Panama.
We're going to Panama. There we go. That's right. We keep saying that's what we're going to do. We're going to go to Panama one day.
I'm sure the SEC would love to do the audits down in Panama.
Yeah.
Why not?
There you go. Be a nice little vacation for them.
Yeah.
We may very well open DWA Central America, though. Don't be surprised.
That's right. Well,
but it'll be only Tammy and I to go down there.
It would only be Tommy and I. He and I are the only ones that want to do it. So you're game for it, John.
Yeah, I'll be right behind you.
Well, you know, talking about earthquakes, I tell you what, it feels like the stock market's been rumbling under our feet now for the past year, and it feels like that rumbling doesn't stop. You know, one of the questions that we've gotten from a lot of people is, you know, just looking at plain performance of like the DWA technical leaders, some of the separately managed accounts over the past quarter, since March when this bounce in the market began. And so we thought that today it would be a good idea to kind of have you on, John, and talk a little bit about what happens in relative strength strategies when it underperforms, because no strategy outperforms every single quarter. So let's talk about some of the some of the characteristics of relative strength, when it underperforms, when it's likely to outperform, and kind of take things back in history and talk a little bit about how the portfolios have evolved over time. And I think probably one of the biggest things to start with is coming into 2008, it was a rough year. Up until the middle of March, the S&P 500 was down about 25%. And during that time, the portfolios were holding up very well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, relative strength strategies for the first part of 2008 did really well. And really the underlying reason behind that is there was defined leadership in terms of outperformance. So the banks were still getting really hit, and a lot of these companies that were really kind of on the brink of bankruptcy were really getting smashed. But you had things that were holding up well, like consumer staples, healthcare, things like that that really kind of do well in a recessionary environment. And that had been going on for a little while. So that trend was in place, it was identifiable, and it had been sustainable. And so you could latch onto that and really overweight the portfolio in that area. And that's what allowed a relative strength strategy to hold up a little bit better while the market was really cratering the first part of the year.
And then all of a sudden that changed. Like we have experienced really since the middle of 2008, things have changed on a dime, correct?
Well, it wasn't the portfolios they managed didn't just do well up the first quarter. I mean, it did right. Well up to the half a year.
In 2008, yes.
2008, yeah. If you look at the DWAFX, which is our mutual fund, that was up handily coming into the beginning of August before everything became correlated.
Right.
And it because it had a piece of commodities, and commodities was doing extremely well. You know,
That's
had that
right.
in there.
That's right. You had that part in there in 2008. And then, you know, this quarter, middle of March 2009, things began to change, right? The trends began to shift in the marketplace.
Yeah, and it seems like it was really almost overnight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've had two totally different markets in 2009, and everything that had done horribly up until the beginning of March has done spectacularly from March up until now. And it's been a very rapid change, and it's really what we refer to as the laggard bounce. And that's not uncommon to see that, and it happens. And all we mean by that is the stocks that had really been crushed and had not been doing well have all of a sudden started to do much, much better than the market.
Well, give us an example of, like, what you're talking about when you say a laggard, you know, type of stock and just how well it's done.
I think the best example are a lot of the bank stocks, mm-hmm. something like Citigroup, Fifth Third Bank Corp, or maybe even something like AIG, that's an insurance stock that's been in the headlines. All these stocks were basically going out of business as far as equity investors were concerned. They had all been bid down to, you know, under a dollar, you know, and just terribly, terribly crushed. And all of a sudden now it looks like, hey, they might not all go out of business. And so there's been a huge relief rally. So while these stocks might still be down 80-90% from their old highs, they've rallied quite a bit off the bottom, you know, a couple hundred percent. And so that's a good example of what's gone on. We had the same thing back in 2002, 2003. It was a little different, though. It wasn't the bank stocks back then. It was the technology stocks. And a lot of those little internet stocks have been, you know, bid down to 50 cents, 75 cents, and there was a huge rally in those stocks in, you know, the end of 2002, 2003. So that's another time period when we've seen this type of thing. And all that's happening is these things just have been beaten down too far, and they're kind of coming back when the market realizes that, hey, this whole thing is not going to go out of business. They might be impaired for years to come, but there still is some value left in the company.
So it's kind of like the internet stocks back in 2002 when everyone on Wall Street, some of the biggest names, some people who have TV shows now that I would almost call the WWF of Wall Street, you know, CNBC, all of them saying that the technology craze will never end. You got to keep buying these stocks, buy these stocks, buy these stocks. Next thing you know, you have a stock that goes from $100 to $2, and Mr. Jones looks at it and says, wow, this is pretty cheap. We loved it at 100. Now it's 2. Let's buy it. Mm-hmm. And it bounces from 2 to 4 or 6. And next thing you know, 100, 200% gain. And off the bottom, that makes these laggers look really, really good. But you're still dealing with a company that has a high probability of filing bankruptcy.
Right. Either filing bankruptcy or just kind of treading water for years. And we've seen a lot of that with the technology stocks. I mean, recently, they've begun to be leaders. But, you know, you had years there where they were still kind of languishing. And it's been a long time since that peak in 2000, since those technology stocks as a whole have really been gathering steam.
Well, ask any holder of Cisco, you know, who bought it in 2000 when it was $80 or even $60, or Microsoft, or any, like you said, any other number
EMC.
Of these names, EMCs, that's still a teenager. It's been down in the single digits from $98. You know, so like you said, you know, those things peaked in 2000. They had a bounce in 2003. But they're nowhere near those old highs again, and nowhere absolutely near it, where other sectors have really taken that leadership role. And you look at stocks that were in, like, for instance, the energy sector, and those things, you know, moved on to new highs. Mm.
Yeah, and there's an old saying that, you know, what led the last bull market doesn't lead the next one. And that's kind of, you know, that whole technology and financials example works here, too. I mean, the technology stocks led that bull market in the 90s, but they certainly didn't lead the, you know, the bull market mid this decade, where, you know, it was more the financials, commodities did well, the energy stocks did well. The tech stocks, you know, is a big group, did not do as well and did not have that massive leadership role that they had in the last bull market. And if we get another one here, you know, it's probably a safe bet that financials and banks and things like that will probably do something similar to the technology stocks. That's kind of happened through history, and oftentimes it takes years of repair before these things are really ready to be dynamic leaders again.
Well, John, Go ahead, Annie.
I was going to say, so in other words, you may have pops from these things, but typically those pops don't last very long. And that's really where the relative strength comes in that I think is important for people to understand. We measure not only the how things move, but we're also looking at the sustainability of that move. So in other words, what we want to have is we want to have something that begins to outperform, but not just outperform for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, but have some sustainability. Because what we found is when you have a lot of short-term signals, you get a lot of false starts in there, right?
Yeah, you're right. When you have these short-term signals, you have a lot of things flipping in and out, in and out, in and out. And the shorter you go, the more noise there is in the market. And you want to stretch it out a little bit and make sure that that trend is sustainable so that you can latch onto it and you can, you know, hopefully hold these things a little longer than a couple weeks. I mean, you know, you're looking for, you know, the kind of 6 to 18 month holding period, and that's really where the inefficiency lies. It's not at the real short term levels on these relative strength type models.
Well, let's think about then 2002's market and 2003 and how some of the portfolio performances happened. As you mentioned, we had a lag in 2002, right? The end of 2002, first quarter of 2003 or so in all of the technical leader type indices, correct?
Yeah, and what worked well for the first part of 2002 was some stuff that had held up much better, you know, not having technology stocks, not having biotech, not having telecom, that was a big key, and having some consumer staples and some of these more low beta things, that was really what allowed those things to outperform for the first part of 2002. Then when you get this big reflex rally off the bottom, a big laggard bounce, you know, that stuff just does not perform in that type of bounce. And what does well was the things that we had avoided and really got crushed, like biotech, telecom, technology, things like that.
Mm-hmm. So it makes you appear that you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, but it's like a spring. I mean, these stocks have been so hammered so badly in the technology area that it's like, you know, then the market pushes them down even further. It's like compressing a spring.
It is like compressing a spring, and the farther they get cranked down, you know, the more that thing is going to bounce back up.
Right.
And, you know, we saw that in 2002 and in the technology stocks, and we're seeing that now in the financials, insurance stocks, things like that.
Well, I think one thing that's always been enlightening for me is to look back at the technical leaders index when we did the back test on that, and we used what we call point-in-time data. Can you tell people what point-in-time data is and why it's important to use that when you do some type of back test?
Yeah, point-in-time data is just a fancy way to say that the data we're using is how it was way back when.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all it is. So when we look and we're testing something back into, say, the late 90s, that database is exactly how it was back in the late 90s. So the stocks that have gone out of business, like Enron, WorldCom, that stuff is in the database.
Mm-hmm.
We have stuff that's been bought out in the database. If you exclude that stuff, you know, obviously you have problems calculating it because you'll never buy a stock that goes bankrupt, right, because it's not in your database.
Right.
So we've gone back and constructed this so it's a very realistic picture of how things were at the time.
So it forces you to be in stuff that went bankrupt if it did, instead of cherry picking. You're going to be in what is.
That's right. You're not cherry picking at all. And in a lot of our tests that we've done, you know, whether it be a technical leaders test, a systematic RS test, we've owned Enron, for example, in a lot of those portfolios at times. Because it was a pretty good RS stock until it began to unravel. And then, you know, the model, you have to make sure your model is designed to kick that kind of stuff out in a timely fashion. So, you know, that stuff is in there. And it's important that you have that so it's an accurate picture.
Yeah, I think that's important to keep in mind when, you know, about how people conduct their historical research and so forth. And when I go back and I look at that technical leaders index all the way back to 1997, what I see is that, you know, you look at 12 years worth of data, and in 5 of those years, we underperformed. And in fact, if you look at the number of quarters, technical leaders index outperformed 2/3 of the time on a quarterly basis and underperformed 1/3 of the time. Okay, so 33% of the time it underperforms. They're definitely going to be underperforming quarters. But I think here's the most telling thing, is if you held the technical leaders from March 31st, 1997 to the end of 2008, so includes 2008's debacle, you're up 176% versus the S&P 500 being up 19%. So what I see happen when I look at this is you get a year or two of underperformance, and then you have 3 or 4 years of outperformance, and that spread of outperformance is really tremendous in the portfolio.
The scary part comes in, though, John, and the thing that sticks in my mind is let's look at 2008. That was a pretty harrowing experience for everybody. I mean, when I look at the DWAFX, I just love the way that's constructed, and I think it can be the center, the sun of a universe in a portfolio. And it did so well all the way down to the beginning of August, and then it got absolutely obliterated. Although it came in, you know, it beat the S&P 500 handily, I think it also beat its own bogey. But the point with the individual managed accounts did well for most of the year. But then when relative strength went out of favor, or when everything became correlated, in other words, the margin clerks took control of selling stocks and commodities and everything else, the strong relative strength did worst. And you would have thought that, okay, gee, even though I'm going to be in a tsunami here and we're going over the edge of the cliff, I should not do as bad as the other stocks would because I'm in strong relative strength stocks. When, in fact, when that happened and we went over the cliff, the strong relative strength stocks did worse than the others, and you actually lost more than the S&P itself.
Yeah, and I think, you know, those strong RS stocks really held up well up until those summer months. And that, I think, is, you know, that was kind of a fairly normal thing in terms of relative strength because that trend was definable and sustainable up until that point. The financials were doing horribly, but there was some stuff holding up.
Like what? When you say there was some stuff, what is the stuff?
That you know, stocks like, you know, the commodities-based stuff, the consumer staples, things like that. But then, as you mentioned, you know, the margin clerks kind of take over, and there's all this forced liquidation all over the place. And I think what really wound up happening was people sold whatever they could sell, and that was the stuff that had held up the best. You know, they had the most value out of that stuff, and they just took it all and threw it all out the window. And that was a very, very, you know, odd period. We hadn't seen that before. In 2002, for example, you know, have that forced liquidation. You don't see that in 2002. You're able to be on those trends through the whole deal. And so 08 was really, you know, that was a tough period really for any strategy, and that forced liquidation really changes the ballgame.
I mean, that pretty much took a few years of good performance right out of the ballpark, didn't it?
Sure,
I mean, where would you have stood if you came into DWA's, let's say, the core position in 2001? And by the end of 2008, would you have still been up?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the spread that we've seen has really taken the strong RS stuff back to like 2006 levels. So, you know, we've undone in this latest laggard rally a lot of the outperformance that's been generated since 2006.
So you could have come in 2006 and you'd be pretty much even now. You gave it all up in 2008.
Yeah, I mean, you're giving a lot of it up in 08, and then this later, the 2009 laggard rally that we're seeing.
What about the person
giving a lot up?
What about the person who comes in pretty much at the top and says, you know, gee, I really like what's going on. I want to embrace what you do. And you, no one is clairvoyant by any stretch of the imagination, but they get in at the top. Like maybe they put their money into the investment, let's say, June or July of 2008. Then what happens?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that is going to be much tougher to recover from when the investment comes in right at the top. What we do know in looking at our data and looking at data from another source, which is a Ken French library that goes actually all the way back like into the 20s, and he tests some stuff. But relative strength models tend to, like on a three-year rolling basis, for example, you tend to have outperformance on the order of 80 to 85% of the time. On a three-year rolling basis, you're outperforming. That number goes up on a five-year basis, and on a 10-year basis, you're looking real good. And like Ken French's data, every single decade from the 20s forward, relative strength outperformed its benchmark. So if you come in at the very, very top, obviously, you know, it's going to be tougher in the short run to recover from, but relative strength has shown a remarkable ability to adapt and deliver good performance over, you know, what is really considered a good period of time for equities, you know, like a 3 to 5 year time horizon.
You know, you get to a point where people have a very low time horizon. I mean, if they looked at modern portfolio theory and they said, okay, they bought into that philosophy, and it's just, you know, don't worry, be happy, over the long term, nobody ever loses, and here's what you're going to be a millionaire by the time you retire, and they look back now and they say, you know, it's 10 years. You know, let's say I was 60 years old 10 years ago, and you told me, which is what the strategic allocation models did in the year 2000, is that I could expect 11% going forward, and now here I am 70 years old 10 years later, and he says, how long do I have to wait for long term? You know, so people's long term horizon gets shorter and shorter and shorter, you know, as you go along.
Well, and I think the other thing too, that when you look at it as well, is that when we run a systematic account or technical leaders, we are 100% invested. We are not moving to cash in that portfolio.
So that brings me to my next question.
That's right. So you are fishing in a pond in which you know, you're only given X opportunity, and the best opportunities for relative strength are when there is a large differential between best and worst performing issues and when that leadership is sustainable. Correct, John?
Yeah, that's right. Relative strength strategy loves big dispersion in returns, and all that means is, say, a top performing group, like, you know, just like basic materials might be plus 100% for the year, and if you've got something like financials that's minus 20, then that's great because you can find that leadership and you can avoid the laggards, and that is perfect scenario for relative strength strategy.
But you could also be fishing in a pond where it's nothing but rotten fish, and that's all you've got to select from, and relative strength is going to pick the best rotten fish it can, but still you got rotten fish.
That's right.
Therein lies the problem of being invested 100% of the time at all times. Now, this leads me to my question with you. Are you designed for a person to put 100% of their portfolio with you?
No, and we've never advocated doing that, just shipping all of the money to one strategy, which might be relative strength. It's always a good idea to have different strategies in the overall portfolio. So we know relative strength, that's really our expertise, and we're good at implementing those strategies. But we might not know as much about managing a deep value portfolio. And so going to another mutual fund or another investment manager to implement that type of piece is often a good offset, and it's a totally different strategy. So oftentimes when relative strength is out of favor, that kind of value strategy might be in favor. You might prefer a market timing type strategy or something else. But there's a number of different things you can do to spread your capital out over a number of different strategies in the portfolio.
Yeah, I think that's key. Is what you're trying to do is create a smooth ride in the portfolio. I mean, we know equities, you know, here we know how to trade them, but that doesn't mean that 100% of my money or your money is in equities.
Yeah,
we have a municipal bond portfolio, you know. So
right.
If you smooth out that strategy and those bonds.
Yeah, in other words, if I had $1 million and I put $200,000 with you, I could really I wouldn't have any problem riding out the rough times. You know,
that's
knowing
right.
That
that's right. And all these high performing strategies have patches where they underperform. And, you know, I think if you sit back and think about it, if they didn't have patches where they underperformed, then just everyone would do it and there'd be no return in it anymore.
Didn't Bernie Madoff do that?
Exactly. And we found out what happened with that. So
that's right.
So, you know, there is that kind of thing too. And you just, you know, you have to be ready for those periods of underperformance. And actually from a, you know, from an overall allocation standpoint, those are the periods when you want to increase your exposure to those strategies, not, you know, pull money off the table.
Yeah. Well, let's go to this year so far, you know, with managed accounts. You know, the first you outperformed handily the first couple of months of the year, January, February, into March. But then March 12th, when the New York Stock Exchange bullish percent, our indicator for U.S. equities, went to offense, that's when you had that – remember we talked about that laggard bounce again off the bottom, which just really kind of left you in the dust.
Yeah, and we've done a few studies, one that you guys put in the report on point and figure signals, and, you know, the sell in O category from that
right.
time period did – much, much better than the buy in X's, which are traditionally the stocks that a high relative strength strategy is going to
get. Anyone who's new to this, let's say sell an O means if you're looking at a point and figure chart and you have a column of O's that exceeds the previous column of O's, that's a sell signal. And if that pattern is still in a column of O's, that's even worse short term. So in essence, what you're saying is if you had the ability in those accounts that you manage that and you knew that this would be a laggard bounce, you could have jumped from high relative strength, more high quality stocks into really the low quality stocks and the springs that have been tightened up and jump into that and have caught that move.
That's right.
However, what would you have done? How could you explain buying AIG, you know, at a dollar or...
Yeah, and I think that's the differential, too, in the fact that, you know, in the research report, you know, we'll feature bottom fish plays because they're designed to be trading type of vehicles. When someone puts their money with Dorsey Wright Money Management, you know, we're looking, you know, we also have to look at it from a fiduciary responsibility. Like you said, can you buy that AIG that's about ready to go out of business? Yes, I think it may bounce from $1 to $2. And yes, that could be a great trading play that you do in the portfolio. But that's probably not your bread and butter money that you want playing a stock that's about ready to go into bankruptcy. Is kind of the way I look at it. But that, like you mentioned, you know, that might be a piece of your other part of your portfolio that allows you to take advantage of trading opportunities. Sometimes there are opportunities out there that covered rights work great. We don't do covered rights at Dorsey Wright Money Management, you know. So there are, you would take a piece of your portfolio, and then you're working with the other piece to take advantage of individual opportunities out there.
This is where dealing with a well-educated craftsman like the professionals who deal with Dorsey Wright & Associates would be able to keep you abreast of these type of trading ideas and help you manage it.
Exactly. So are you seeing any changes right now, John, with respect to relative strength that, you know, some of this, you know, laggard bounce here off the bottom, does any of it look like it has legs? Anything showing up in the current runs on relative strength?
Yeah, we're not seeing a lot of stuff going into the financial area, but I think what's most interesting is we're seeing a more rotation into technology now. And that, to me, is actually very, very interesting. We've put some technology positions into our portfolios, and that is something that if we get that trend going, that is one that can often be very sustainable, and we can really capitalize on that type of thing. So I think that's really been kind of the most exciting thing that we're seeing, and it's not so much that these banks and stuff are actually, you know, being put into the portfolio. It's that we've got other stuff out there that even through this laggard bounce has actually started to show some strength. Where we're seeing the strength kind of leaving the portfolios, things like consumer staples and a lot of this kind of cement stuff that holds up well in a down market, that stuff's getting rotated out in favor of more higher beta type stuff.
That's right. And I think one of the other points that you made kind of subtly maybe that kind of stuck in my mind earlier in the conversation was that the real opportunity lies in that 6 to 18 month period with respect to measuring relative strength. And so, you know, we may see something that performs really well over a 6-week period, but if we step back from that position, like the Office Depot, like the Citigroup, like the AIG, and step back and say, okay, yeah, this performed great for the last 6 weeks, but how has it performed over the last 6 months? How has it performed over the last 18 months? You know, it's nowhere near being a leader. So you kind of sometimes have to step back from the tree so you can see the forest there and say, hey, yeah, it's done well the past 6 weeks, but not the past 6 months.
And that is very difficult to do while you're going through it. People, as you say, often have trouble seeing the forest through the trees as you're actually going through these things. But oftentimes when you look back at it, you say, oh, yeah, that's very clear. Like earlier in the call when we're talking about what's going on in 2002, 2003, you know, it's, oh, yeah, it's very clear, and this happened and that happened. But when you're actually going through it, it's a totally different ballgame.
Yeah, it brings me back to one of our long-term clients, Stan, who's been in this business for over 50 years. And, you know, as we've gone through rough patches and stuff, I'll ask him, Stan, how did this compare back to the 60s, you know? And how did this compare back to the 70s? And he'll say, whatever market you're living through is the worst market that there is. That's the worst one because, like you said, it's hard to get perspective until you step away from it. We can can all step back and get perspective, like you said, on 2003 and say, yeah, it all worked out. Look, it was a rough couple of quarters there. You felt like you were in the spin cycle, and but you know, it all worked out.
The fear and they were really not much different than what we're seeing in 2008, 2009. I mean, it was people were frightened and just like they were last year. But that, kind of time heals all wounds, and they don't tend to remember that type of thing.
That's right. Yeah, it's hard to remember exactly how you felt. Back then.
And that's one of the reasons that you really need to have such a disciplined type of process, whether it's a systematic type process or whether you just sit down and make a very detailed checklist about what you require to buy and sell stocks, and you just kind of run through that because it's. You can get very emotional about these types of things, and that really doesn't help anybody. Knowing what works in the long term and just implementing that day after day is really what is going to lead to good performance over time.
Yeah, and I think that's an important thing. We're seeing more and more advisors, becoming their own portfolio managers and stuff. So to hear that, from our portfolio manager, what are some of the things that you require? And I think one of the things that I remember specifically is that a lot of times it's not very glamorous. The actual management of it is not per se glamorous trading, that kind of thing. It's really being consistent and staying consistent and, in a good methodology doesn't have to necessarily be complicated, correct?
That's right. And there's a number of different ways to go about doing this. There's, relative strength strategies, value strategies, GARPs. I mean, there's any number of these things. I think the big deal is that you just have to have an incredible amount of discipline to follow these strategies, because there's always going to be a time when it's not working and you'll question whether, is this whole thing broken? And I think history has shown that these things are not broken. They're just not working right now, and they come back. I can remember, in 98, all these value shops were going out of business, and these value players were, totally missing the, quote, new economy. And, it wasn't a year or two, three later that, these guys were the smartest guys in the room. And
were idiots. See, when our relative strength charts back in 2000, for the first time in years, pointed to being in value and small cap, these are the same guys who were vilified a number of years before and saying, you guys don't get it. You've been losing money. You've been out of the pocket for a long time.
Have you not seen a computer?
Then, if these guys didn't go out of business and they just hung in there, the next thing you know is value and small cap was the greatest place since for the next 7 years. That's all you had to be is in that.
And that's why the discipline is so incredibly important. There's a lot of these strategies that work over time, and knowing that and thoroughly testing them and believing in them, it will allow you, to do that. But you also need to, from a day-to-day standpoint, really figure out what your, what's going to be your methodology and just stick to it and just keep pounding. And one of the portfolio managers here has made reference to the fact that portfolio management's often, like a hot dog. I mean, it's kind of messy, and you don't always want to know what goes into it, but what comes out is usually pretty good. And it's that type of thing where the day-to-day can often be mundane and certainly not very glamorous. But, if you stick to it and you kind of keep it rolling, then these things, as they come in and out of favor, you're able to capitalize on your investment strategy.
I think where the problem many investors have, and, this just keeps sticking in my mind, a lot of phone calls that I get, like over this last 2008, and as a matter of fact, how did Warren Buffett do in 2008?
You talk about
somebody who sticks to his guns and does the same thing. I think he was down big time.
I think he was down pretty handily too. I mean, nobody escaped it.
I think he was 40 or 50%.
Yeah, he had a rough go, and I remember he was one of those guys too in the late '90s that totally didn't understand the new economy, and but he came back just fine.
Right, and I mean, if you talk about a guy who follows his discipline, and Warren Buffett was down big in 2008. That's a guy who doesn't deviate from what he does.
That's right.
Right.
Now I forgot about my train of thought that I was going down. Where was I going,
Tammy? A lot of
Tammy?
Calls from people.
Oh, yeah, good. I'm glad I got you with me all the time.
I don't know. I'm not much better these days.
you know, a lot of the calls I think I get when, you know, a person says, geez, you know, we have accounts out there in California, and, man, you guys are really underperforming, you know, over this last 2008 and that type of thing. And it makes me think that, you know what, they probably have an account that's 100% there, mm-hmm. you know, instead of like it's really designed to be as a piece of the equation. You know, instead of sending the whole account, you send a piece of the account, and then you can sit through these times that become extremely tough, like a 2008. And, mm-hmm. Well, first few months of 2009 were really good, and then you had that laggard bounce. Mm-hmm. And I think we come back and, you know, by the end of 2009, we'll be fine. But I think most of the people who get worried or have too much out there, too much of a percent of account there.
Or too much just in equities in general. Hmm.
Or you're in the aggressive account. See, there's three accounts out there. One of the ones that I have accounts in are the lowest aggressive, where, you know, it's the core position with the bonds.
Uh-huh.
I prefer to be in that. Account. You know, right. I don't have any races to win anymore. That's, you know, right. So my cousin's accounts are there and that type of thing.
Yeah. I think that's the key, is that what we're doing here is we're running a marathon, and these portfolios are not designed to run a sprint, right? I mean, you can take RS and make it designed to run a sprint, correct, John?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we can do a lot of things to reduce the tracking error and mm-hmm. keep it closer to the S&P, so you don't have these, you know, stretches where, you know, you're dramatically underperforming the benchmark. The problem is the long-term performance is not nearly as good. And, you know, as a side note, I mean, that's what a lot of the industry has gone to, is
that's right.
Closet index approach. And, you know, my belief in that is if you want to do that, just go and buy an index fund and then go find a manager that can add a lot of alpha and might deviate from the benchmark a lot, but just have that a smaller piece. So maybe you buy just 70% of an index fund and 30% of, you know, some other manager, instead of going this whole closet index approach that, you know, frankly has not proven to be one that's going to add a lot of value over time.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you find most mutual funds, you talk to Steve, our mutual fund guy, most of these mutual funds are really clones of the S&P 500. I mean, they try to stay as close as they can to it.
So you never have to answer this question.
Yeah, and then they never deviate from their game plan, you know, and you don't have to answer that question. I think that's a great idea, John. A person, you know, that wants to say, okay, I'm interested in being an index, just go buy the SPY, which is the spiders, open an account, buy it there, and then go look for the alpha with, you know, you take a piece and you give it to your guys. You say, okay, I want to be in the aggressive portfolio. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to rock and roll. Let's put it on the line. But most of my money, I've got it over here in the S&P 500, and I've also got another manager over here, another one over here. But that core piece, right. Which is the sun, maybe I put my planets around the sun, but my core piece is that big sun in the middle of the sky.
And I think that's, you know, that's one of the questions that we get a lot here on the research side, is people come back to evaluating what their overall strategy is. What is their overall universe going to look like? What is that sun going to be? Is that sun going to be the DWA FX? Is the sun going to be my strategic asset allocation? Is my sun going to be the S&P 500? You know, what do I want my sun to be? And then what are the pieces that are going to go off of that? And there's no one right
or
answer.
Or a Vanguard
for
market model.
Yeah, that's right. That might be your son. You know, there's a lot of right answers there. There's not just one right answer. And that's going to depend upon your overall outlook. But the key is that you've got all of these great tools available to you to create a strategy that you can be comfortable with. And like John said, you can stick with it day in and day out and stay with your universe. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So.
Well, yeah, I think we've pretty much answered all the questions that I had. You know, I was interested in doing, I wanted a nice paper trail of how the accounts managed over the years, and I think we covered that, you know, 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know.
Right.
The trouble really began in 2006 from there on.
Right.
If you got in, you did well, but then in 2008 right. was such a rough year, you gave it all back.
Well, I think you said it best. You know what? The margin clerks had a margin call, and they regressed everything back to mean. They regressed things that had performed well back to 2006 levels.
Yeah.
And so we'll, you know, work forward from this point, but it didn't really matter. There was nowhere to hide. I think that's the biggest key. Even in 2002, if you look at the Technical Leaders Index, what's interesting about the year 2002, while the PDP or Technical Leaders Index was down 11.9%, and the S&P was down 23.3%, so the portfolio was down, but you outperformed by 11% that year because there was defined leadership in 2002.
Well, what was the leadership you were in 2002 that caused you to outperform? To be down, but outperform.
Yeah, the stuff that was doing well was things like consumer staples, some of the financials, and like home builders and stuff like that was doing okay. And we were totally avoiding all the technology, biotech, telecom,
right.
You know, the real screamers from the last bull market. So those are kind of the two sides of the coin that allowed it to do so well. Another time when we really outperformed was like 2005 in the separately managed accounts, for example. That a lot of that was the energy trade, and you know there was, for example, the refining capacity was real limited, and then the hurricane Katrina hits in 2005, and things just go bananas, and you know you're on that trade, and you know that was one theme that really caused that. So these themes kind of emerge, and you get on the theme, and it somehow tends to be exacerbated by something along the way, and it allows you to really put up big performance numbers.
Yeah, and in 2001, probably the closest thing we have to 2008 is after 9/11 in 2001. And in that market, which, you know, the markets were closed for a week, opened back up, and then for the next week to 7 days, fell precipitously every single day. And there was nothing that was spared in that decline as people, once again, reevaluated world order, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at that time period, too, when we had a bounce in the fourth at the end of the fourth quarter of 2001, we underperformed in that particular quarter because once again you had a situation where a lot of the laggards bounced first,
mm-hmm.
and then the next quarter you were right back on track in 2002. But that's probably the last closest thing we had to a change in world order where people questioned how things worked, much like we did in 2008. People
yeah.
questioned whether the financial system was going to continue to work and go forward. So,
well, one of the things that I'm hearing, John, too, is one of the keys to performance is not necessarily what you own, it's what you don't own.
That's
it's the stuff you don't have in the portfolio.
That's right, and that was Alan Shaw's big thing. He was a technician over at Smith Barney, and he was always fond of saying, you know, your performance is determined as much of by what you own as what you don't own. And I think, you know, we always try to make that clear and talk about what we own and what we don't own, because what you don't, people focus so much on buying the stocks,
right?
That, you know, and it's so, you know, they're focused on either chart patterns or fundamentals or whatever, that there's this whole universe of stocks out there that you don't own. And making sure you've got the right mix of stuff in and out of the portfolio is going to really determine your performance.
Right, right, exactly.
And John, it's always wonderful to talk to you and get some insights as to things that you all are seeing and perspective from, managing the account, being a money manager, some of those psychological things that go along with it. Like Tommy said, building the timeline. So it's always great to talk to you, and we'll do it again at the end of the quarter and get another update.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get another update when we get all the ETFs reconstituted and talk about what we're seeing and, you know, what's happened from this point forward.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about what you don't own.
That's right, and what we own.
All right, John. Well, hope you guys don't have any more earthquakes out there.
Yeah, we'll keep our fingers crossed.
There we go.
And you can always move away if you want.
That's right. All we need is an internet connection.
Thanks, John.
All right, thank you.